Jonathan Drury is captivated by what he describes as the riotous and often bizarre plant world. His first book, Around the World in 80 Trees, was a bestseller. Took him aback, and now comes Around the World in 80 Plants. Drury has made over 50 BBC science and technology documentaries. He was, for nearly a decade, a trustee of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, when he accompanied botanical expeditions, and it inspired his world tour books. Around the World in 80 Plants is a thing of beauty, actually. It's illustrated by Lucille Clerc, and it's a plea to pay attention to both the showy and the humble. Drury is due to speak at Word Christchurch later this year, and we began with a humble plant, the dandelion.
It's an amazing thing, but a lot of plants have latex in the either in the roots or in the bark that is really there for the plant to be able to protect itself. But we found, obviously, with rubber with rubber trees that you can make wonderful things out of it, including car tires. And then someone thought, do you know what? I wonder if we boil up that latex that you get from dandelions, whether we'll get the same thing. And you do. And there's a particular kind of dandelion called the Russian dandelion, which looks practically the same as every other dandelion, frankly, which is particularly good for making rubber out of. And during the war, when supplies from the Far East to Europe were disrupted, they put quite a lot of effort into growing dandelion for rubber.
And the United States is doing it now?
There are people in the United States and in Europe, actually. There's a big European project to produce rubber out of dandelions, and you can buy the first tyres. I think they're made by Continental in the United States, made out of dandelion rubber.
Is it supposed to be more sustainable than rubber trees?
Well, it's more sustainable in that growing rubber trees generally means chopping down a whole load of forest in order to grow those trees. Whereas dandelions can be grown on regular agricultural land.
It's interesting, isn't it? So we're seeing vast, plantations of dandelions now, are we?
Here and there, it's still experimental. I mean, if you really want to go and see dandelions en masse, then the place to go is Estonia, where they've sort of embraced the dandelion as their kind of national flower, and they have dandelion festivals and make dandelion jam and all sorts. But they're just wild there. But, if you want to see cultivated fields, then there are some in Eastern Europe and some in the United States.
We're being encouraged to eat dandelion leaves now for their nutritive content. No problem with eating the latex at the same time?
There's not too much latex in the leaves. It's mostly in the roots. And dandelions do have this sort of side effect of making you want to pee. In fact, the French word for dandelion is pissenlit, which means, pee in the bed.
Good to know. That should have a health warning on it. Another thing that should have a health warning on it, it seems to me, is licorice, which in relatively modest quantities can do you quite some damage, it seems.
Yeah, you only need a handful a day for about 2 weeks to really throw your kind of bodily hormones off balance, and you start getting heart arrhythmia and palpitations and all sorts of bad stuff happens. And you can imagine with that kind of low dose, it's actually not that uncommon. One of the things that doctors ask when people are referred to hospital with sort of symptoms that don't have any other clear explanation is, have you been chewing a lot of licorice? And the people who really have gone for licorice in a big way are the Scandinavians. And, you go to Finland or Norway or somewhere, and they've got this very sort of adult version of licorice, which is A, strong, and B, it's got a chemical called ammonium chloride in it, which is very sort of sharp, tangy thing. It's definitely a very adult confection. And that comes with a warning on it saying, absolutely pregnant women should avoid all licorice, never eat it at all. Everyone else only in moderation and preferably not for kids.
Is the ammonium chloride in the plant already, or do they add it?
No, that's something they add in just to, spice it up a bit. I don't think the ammonium chloride is particularly harmful. It's the actual chemicals in licorice itself. But you know, I should say that having the odd licorice sweet or licorice ice cream isn't going to kill you. You know, it's just you don't want to do it regularly.
One of the things that your book makes one ponder is how on earth people discovered that some of these were useful or edible in the first place.
Yes, I mean, there are lots of plants like that where you think to yourself, what was going through someone's mind? You know, there are some things where, it's just not very nice to eat and you have to sort of wash it a lot, like cassava or manioc or those sort of things. But something like cashew nuts, which are embedded in this kind of caustic oil that dangles down in a sort of funny kidney-shaped bean thing from beneath the fruit, that'll attack your fingers, let alone your throat and your stomach. So how someone discovered that actually, if you kind of get these things out and boil them up and roast them a bit, then they're really palatable and not poisonous at all. I mean, that is sort of amazes me.
People must have been very, very hungry.
Yeah, or human beings, their curiosity knows no bounds.
One of the things that made me think about that was indigo. How, not edible, but how did people work out how to dye cloth with it, given that it's not an automatic, commonsensical thing because it goes pale before it goes dark?
That's right, and you need to sort of add other chemicals and things to make it go the color you want. I like to think that there was someone who was just kind of standing around on the edge of this sort of bath full of various herbs that had been sort of added to hot water, and accidentally kicked something in, and it went bright blue, and they thought, do you know what? There's a business in this.
Almost all indigo is synthetic now. How do you feel about that? Do you think that's a good thing? Presumably, it's not so good for the environment given the processing of it. Or do you
Yeah.
think that it's just the way it is? It frees up land to grow other stuff, or what?
Well, there isn't anything wrong with synthetic things in themselves. It just depends how they're made. And synthetic dyes tend to be made out of coal and fossil fuel products.
Yeah.
So we're trying to use less of those. And also, quite a lot of those sort of coal and fossil fuel based dyes are actually a bit irritant to some people's skin. And some of the natural dyes are a bit kinder. So actually, indigo is natural indigo is having a bit of a rebirth, and people are sort of turning to it because it's a little bit gentler on the environment. And indigo plants are a member of the legume family, which includes peas and beans and things like that, which actually add fertilizer to the soil when they grow in them. They sort of grab nitrogen out of the air in this very clever chemical reaction and fertilize the soil, which means that you don't have to use all these other kind of nasty fertilizers on the soil afterwards. So they actually improve the soil for other plants.
How do the nitrogen fixing plants work?
Well, there are these bacteria called rhizobium that live in nodules in the roots that fix the nitrogen out of the air. A clever chemical reaction that the nitrogen sort of percolates with the air down into the soil, and these bacteria kind of grab that and combine it with other chemicals to sort of fix it and turn it into fertilizer. The sort of clever thing is that that fertilizer then improves the soil for other plants that come along afterwards.
I wonder, I know that a theme of your book is the use of fossil fuels and the loss of biodiversity, industrial farming. Do you think that we could get enough nitrogen to feed our crops by not using artificial fertilizers, but by using nitrogen-fixing plants?
Yes, I think there's good evidence that that's the case. In fact, most farms in the world, the sort of industrial chemical manufacturers would have you believe that everything is produced on enormous farms. But most farms are using much less in the way of chemicals than we do when we have sort of huge monocultures that depend on pesticides and artificial fertilizers. And if you rotate crops, And if you grow the right combinations of crops, then they can sort of support each other. And, you know, these crops are very, very good at fixing nitrogen out of the air. So this is what organic farms do. They use clover. The new breeds of clover are absolutely fantastic at getting nitrogen out of the air. And it's a much more efficient way of doing it. You know, the trouble with producing nitrogen fertilizers artificially is that not only do you need masses of energy to do it, and the energy comes from fossil fuels, but on top of that, one of the main ingredients is methane, which is itself natural gas, which is a fossil fuel. So it's doubly bad to use industrial fertilizers. And of course, the industrial fertilizers leach out of the soil, end up in rivers, and get washed out to sea, and you get sort of algal blooms that sort of kill everything, and you get dead zones and so on. So, you know, that all has a cost. Much better to use nitrogen-fixing legumes if you can.
If we could feed the world without artificial fertilizers, that would be good. But do you think that that's feasible?
Yes, I think it is. I think if we reorganized farming, we could dramatically reduce the amount of artificial fertilizers that we need, and at the same time reduce the other chemicals that we need as well, because we would end up growing crops either in rotation or in smaller units, crops that support each other, like growing sort of squash and corn and other plants. Sort of they act as a team. You know, they support each other. You know, sort of one supplies nitrogen, another one supplies something else, and they grow well together. If we did more of that, then there's no doubt we could dramatically reduce the amount of fertilizer that we need.
I'm talking to Jonathan Drury about his book Around the World in 80 Plants. You're an advocate of eating less meat for environmental reasons, apart from anything else. And amaranth is a plant that you say we should use more. What is it?
Amaranth is a sort of lovely plant that has this sort of beautiful scarlet brush-like inflorescence. It grows in Central America, though it's been planted elsewhere in India and Nepal now as well. Lots and lots of tiny seeds that Peruvian people used to sort of make popcorn out of, or mix with agave syrup and turn into sort of little figures of people and so on. And those figures of people that they turned them into were often deities. And the Spanish conquistadors, when they arrived, were very disapproving of this plant because it sort of seemed to mimic or possibly make fun of the Holy Communion of the Catholics. So they banned people from using the amaranth. And that wasn't really re-established for about 500 years, which is a terrible shame, because not only are the leaves really good and high in vitamins and surprisingly high in protein for leaves, but these seeds have the complete range of amino acids that people need. You've got a very balanced, it's part of a very balanced diet on its own, and a terrific plant to grow.
I'm waiting for somebody to dub it a superfood, or have they done that already?
Well, I think they have from time to time. And it's actually quite a common garden plant, you see amaranth. Occasionally they call it Love Lies Bleeding. In French, they call it Nun's Scourge, because, to the florid 18th century French imagination, they imagined nuns kind of flagellating themselves with this plant.
Talking about flagellating yourself, there's a thing about nettles where people flagellated themselves for some peculiar reason. What is that?
Well, the Romans, I don't know if you can sort of imagine Roman life, but being a Roman centurion posted to the far end of the empire on the border of Hadrian's Wall, which separates England of Scotland now, that is just sort of would have been one of the worst postings, and it was just terrible weather and the Scots were all out to get you. And they used to sort of flagellate themselves with bundles of nettles to try and keep warm. And I think that you know, they wrote in their sort of postcards of the day on what were called the Vindolanda tablets, you know, that they were sort of hitting each other with these bundles of nettles, and I think it was mostly to keep warm. There might have been other reasons, I suppose.
But there's even a word for it, urtication.
Yeah, urtication, isn't that lovely? Yeah, urtica is the Latin word for nettle, and we still talk about urtica as being a sort of skin rash or something. You know, you still see that word actually in scientific circles. And in the southwest of England, there's a nettle eating championship. Where I think the aficionados, they know to roll up the nettles a bit in order to sort of break these tiny hypodermic syringes that the nettle has equipped itself with to inject herbivores with a nasty mixture of histamine and other chemicals to put them off eating it. But of course, nettles are very important in the environment because they may not be great for walkers, but they're fantastic for butterflies and butterfly larvae. And of course, you know, butterfly larvae are protected by these hairs, and so other things don't come along and eat them.
When I was a child, whenever we got stung by nettles, we would rub dock leaves on ourselves, which I always suspected did no good at all. Is it any use?
Well, I'm afraid it probably isn't any use, except there is a sort of psychological benefit, because just as you say, people associate it with childhood and the idea of a parent or a loved one sort of sort of soothing you and calming you down, and at the same time rubbing you with a nettle leaf, so a dock leaf. So I think the association is in people's minds. And that's kind of good enough with pain, isn't it? You just sort of think it'll go away, and it will.
Yeah, so it's a placebo, effectively.
Yes, yeah.
Really, really smelly things. Dead horse arum. And the reason it's smelly, I don't know.
The reason it's smelly.
It has a very complicated way of ensuring that insects pollinate it. Describe that, please.
Well, the dead horse arum, I mean, the name is a bit of a giveaway, isn't it? It lives in the Balearic Islands near to Spain in the Mediterranean. And, I mean, when you catch a whiff of this thing, it is really, really disgusting. And it smells like rotten meat. And it's evolved to smell like rotten meat, so it attracts blowflies that come along thinking that they're going to get a meal. And it not only smells like rotten meat, but it kind of looks like rotten meat. And there's a spathe, a kind of spike that sticks out from the middle of this very lurid leaf that's covered in sort of mottles, like decaying meat, really. And this spike looks like the tail of an animal. And so all the flies go sort of flying towards the base of the tail, thinking they're going to get a good meal. And they fly inside and get kind of trapped for a while, covered in pollen, and then get to escape. And the ones that escape, lizards, the Balearic lizard has cunningly learned to sort of hang around on the leaf, because they know there's going to be a good meal there. So that steals some of the plant's pollinating flies and makes it a little less efficient, I guess. But the lizards have a good time as a result.
There's another smelly thing called Rafflesia. Rafflesia.
Yes.
It's got no roots, and it's got no stems, and it's got no leaves. So how does it qualify as a plant?
Well, it's it is a plant in that it's a flower, and it's in fact a rather beautiful sort of cabbage-sized flower that opens into this huge sort of red and yellow speckled thing, absolutely enormous, the biggest flower in the world actually, and it lives as a parasite within other plants. So it's its roots are kind of completely inside other plants, particularly some kind of vines. And no one can really predict when it's going to pop out. But you know, once in a blue moon, they just suddenly decide to flower. And that's another one that has this amazing smell, or amazingly horrible smell. And you know, attracts flies. They go off to other plants with the pollen sticking to their back. It's an amazing thing that this thing survives at all, because you can imagine that these two flowers that, one is pollinating the other, have to be both blooming at the same time. And, as I say, once in a blue moon.
It is amazing that it survives at all, isn't it? I suppose it's endangered by habitat loss as well.
Well, habitat loss, and also local people think that it's a kind of fertility drug. So a lot of plants are gathered by human beings either as aphrodisiacs or to control fertility in one way or another. So you've got the plants that act as contraceptives, and you've got plants that encourage people to have sex with each other. And people are always finding more and more inventive ways to use plants for those purposes.
It's, I suppose, inadvisable to recommend things as aphrodisiacs because, then we end up with rhinoceroses being killed. But presumably there are plants that are aphrodisiac.
Oh yes. And of
I mean,
course,
it's usually poo-pooed, right? It's usually said there is no evidence that this is aphrodisiac, and so stop plundering it. But
the thing is, if plants are kind of nutritious, then in countries where people have malnutrition, then if they're going to be worried about food before being attracted to other people, they need something that's going to sustain them. So the very, very nutritious foods like avocados and so on tend to have been thought of as aphrodisiacs. And interestingly, when avocados were first introduced to the United States, and they were called alligator pears, and nobody really was very interested in them. And then they rebranded them avocados, and still nobody was really interested. And then the marketing people came, with a big load of publicity and went on the radio to say, the rumor that avocados are an aphrodisiac is complete nonsense. And of course, immediately people thought, aha, we'll have some of that. And then there are things like chocolate, which has been thought of as an aphrodisiac for a long time, and it's partly because of the associations that it's got with kind of security, as well as being something that you generally have that's sweet, perhaps calming. And traditionally, it's one of those things that men and women have shared, rather than coffee, which has been something that certainly in the 18th, 19th century, in coffee houses, it was a very male preserve.
Chocolate's an interesting one, isn't it? Because if they hadn't discovered sugar and had the bright idea of adding sugar to it, it would have remained fairly niche these days, I imagine.
Yes, I mean at the same time that chocolate was being discovered, the Spanish were also finding that sugarcane was easily grown in the Caribbean, and the two things hitting Europe at the same time were a killer combination. Up to then, chocolate had been used by indigenous people in Central and South America as a kind of savory, really, but certainly it was seen even then without the sugar as being an aphrodisiac and sort of food of the gods, really. And in fact, the Latin name Theobroma, it means food of the gods.
One of the other plants that has acquired a certain reputation, not for aphrodisiac properties, but for hallucinatory properties, is wormwood, out of which is made absinthe, which has a
Yes.
hallucinogenic dangerous reputation. Tell me about absinthe.
Well, how they say ab absence makes the heart grow fonder, absinthe makes the heart wander. But in the 19th century, when French soldiers were coming back from the Napoleonic Wars, they had been given absinthe, which is a mixture of wormwood and some other herbs and things, but mainly alcohol. And they'd been told it was a vermifuge, to sort of get rid of worms. And then, yet again, the rumor went round that it was an aphrodisiac. Obviously,
Oh, it was.
something with a whole lot of alcohol in it would be seen that way. And they came, and it tasted really ghastly. So they came back with a taste for it. And it became a kind of very in thing to have. And the way that it became an in thing to have was quite clever, because the marketing people got hold of it and they turned it into a whole ritual. So instead of just sort of knocking back a slug of it, you had a glass with a special spoon on top with sort of slats in it, and a very, very fancy little kind of water pot that you would pour the water through a sugar lump lying on top of the spoon into this kind of clear liquid that was sort of emerald green and sparkly. And as you poured the water in, there was a kind of chemical reaction took place, and this thing went kind of oily, yellow, cloudy, kind of magic thing going on. And people just absolutely went for it. And all the the writers of the day, all the bohemians, they just absolutely loved this. And Van Gogh and other artists, Baudelaire, the writer, and so on, they were all pretty much addicted to the stuff. And it turns out there wasn't so much the problem with the absinthe itself, but people started adulterating it because it was so such a valuable and popular thing. So people started putting any old chemicals in it, and those were the things that really caused the mental problems, and so lots of countries banned absinthe as a result. And it's only recently, in the last sort of decade or two, that it's making a reappearance in Europe, at least. But it still doesn't have any of the really poisonous stuff in it, much to the chagrin, probably, of the marketing people who like to link it with danger and bohemian life.
Tequila is another one that has acquired a certain reputation and comes from the blue agave plant. Is there any evidence that tequila gives you a special feeling as opposed to any other type of alcohol, I wonder?
No, I don't think there is any evidence for that. But again, association is everything. If you think about the common drugs and the difference in experience that we have when we take those. So, for example, if I have a glass of wine with my family, this is a very different experience, I like to think, from, if I'm watching a football match and I see football hooligans sort of swigging alcohol. It's the same drug, but it's having quite a different effect on different people, depending on the context. And I think that's what you've got going on with tequila. I think the people who feel that tequila is making them all sort of misty-eyed and sort of having a kind of romantic moment or a sort of special sentimental moment, I think they're probably associating it with something else.
And just going back to wormwood for a moment, China's found that a variety of it appears to cure malaria, which is...
Yes, yeah. The Chinese sort of went back to very ancient, sort of 2,000-year-old manuscripts to look for various herbal remedies that might suit malaria. And they tested lots and lots of different plants. And one of the plants they tested was a very close relative of wormwood, another kind of Artemisia. And they got a chemical from it called artemisinin, which turns out to have quite strong anti-malarial properties. And that's become the basis of a whole lot of anti-malarial drugs. And there are quite a lot of countries now researching that chemical.
So much still remains mysterious. I mean, why the cock pine is technically a tree, so it's in the wrong book, I imagine. But anyway, it
plants
has
are trees
been...
too, you know.
Cock pines, which are native to New Caledonia, in California, they lean south. And in Australia, they lean north. In other words, they grow towards the equator, wherever they are. Why
That's
would
right.
that be?
Well, I'd love, in a sort of, as a politician would say, I'm so glad you asked me that question, and I'd answer something completely different. But actually, nobody knows. Trees generally grow towards the light, but the light can be, is just generally upwards, isn't it? It's not, it's not a kind of focused thing at one point. And plants have a way of knowing which way is up and which way is down by having these special cells with tiny little kind of globules in them that that basically fall to the bottom of the cell. So that's how the plant knows which way is up. And this is how plants know whether to grow a branch at one angle or another, and all that kind of thing. And most trees grow pretty much towards the light, either straight up, which would make a lot of sense because that reduces the sort of leverage on the roots and stops them tipping over. And some sort of grow here and there, depending on local conditions. But with the Cook pine, they all grow towards the equator wherever they grow, and nobody knows why this is.
You haven't got any bright ideas about why it might be? Come on.
One of the things that we humans do is that we sort of think that evolution is always coming up with the answer for something. And it doesn't necessarily. Sometimes, this could be a byproduct of something else, or it could be just a kind of a bit of a mistake, evolved in some other way. And this came along as a side effect. And in the end, it could be that in some place on the planet, maybe in New Caledonia, there were particular local conditions that meant that that tree did particularly well by pointing towards the equator rather than towards anywhere else, and somehow that's been spread around the world, and all the other plants do it, but we honestly don't know.
I hesitated to use the word reason in connection with evolution. I think when we were talking about the dead horse arum, it's a tricky word because sometimes there is no reason.
That's right. Well, it's what you have to imagine is that there are lots of plants and they're all kind of having little mutations all the time. And when one of them has a mutation that seems to fit the environment that it's in better than the other plants, then it has more babies. And so there are more of those plants with that mutation. And that's how evolution works. And human beings, we are just programmed to recognize patterns even when there aren't any. We look at clouds and we see faces, and we look at plants and we think that they're sentient and sort of deciding to do things. And it's true that there are some plants that, we look at and they seem so kind of ruthlessly intentional about what they do. So that, the carnivorous plants that seem to plan exactly how they're going to lure and trap and eventually digest their prey, then it's difficult for us not to anthropomorphize and say, gosh, that really does feel like a bit of planning there.
Or even sphagnum moss, which, you don't think about too much, really. There it does, lies around on top of bogs. But not only does it send its spores out at 100 kilometres an hour, it sabotages its competitors. I mean, you'd have to think that that was sentient, wouldn't you?
Well, you might. I probably wouldn't, but I can see how people might think that way. I mean, the wonderful thing about sphagnum is that it's just the way it grows, it creates a sort of micro habitat that other plants and even other bacteria really don't like. It's very, very acidic. And it also sequesters a whole lot of nutrients and things from the water that it grows in. So they're unavailable to other things. And so sphagnum bogs are very, very sort of monocultural, actually. There's not a whole lot else growing in them. But one of the sort of factors that comes with that is that it's because it's so sterile and acts like a sponge, you can dry the stuff off and then use it as a surgical dressing. And during the First World War, there were moss drives in Canada and the United Kingdom to go and find moss to be used for surgical dressings at the front. And, fantastically sterile and incredibly super absorbent.
But also it makes the bogs acidic so that you get bog bodies preserved.
Yes, because microorganisms don't really grow well in that very acidic environment, things are pickled, literally. And so you have these bodies that were, thousands of years old that have been dug up, and they're almost perfect. The skin goes a kind of leathery texture, and you can see all the features of the person as if they just sort of died a few years ago. It's just extraordinary.
Here's another mysterious thing, among many mysterious things, tomatoes. And we've known that the flowers dislodge their pollen. The pollen is dislodged from the flowers when the bumblebees raise their wing beat to a middle C buzz. But now, what have they found in terms of delaying tomatoes ripening for the market?
Well, here's a fantastic example of how on earth did people discover this. So
Yes.
scientists in Korea have found that if you play a loud high C to ripening tomatoes, you can delay their ripening by about a week. Now, that may not seem terribly important, but if you're in the tomato business and all your tomatoes come at once, you really do want to delay your ripening by a week because you'll be able to sell so many more of them. But how did someone decide, do you know what? I'm just going to play some really loud sounds to these tomatoes and see what happens.
And why do you think it works?
It seems to affect the way that the plant makes its natural ripening hormone, which is called ethylene. And just why it does that, why it interferes with the sort of something called RNA expression, just why it does that, we don't know. But that seems to be the mechanism, that it's altering the production of its own ripening hormone.
Have you seen all these plants you talk about in the wild?
Not every one of them. Some of them I've seen in botanic gardens around the world, and that's actually a great place to go and observe these plants. Some of them I've been, absolutely fortunate enough to see in the wild, and they're amazing. I mean, one that I've always wanted to see and never have because I've never been to the North Island of New Zealand is the kauri tree, and what an amazing economic history that plant has,
Yeah, extraordinary.
the resin, and having been exported all over the world.
There's a fantastic museum, should you ever get to the North Island of New Zealand, in Dargaville, all about the kauri tree and the gum and the immigrants that it drew to New Zealand. It's had such a huge influence on the history and society of New Zealand.
Yes,
Also
I mean,
threatened, of course, now by Kerry dieback disease.
yes, I mean a lot of trees are threatened because of various pests and diseases that travel with us as we all travel. So, a particular problem is a fungus-like organism called Phytophthora that affects a lot of trees now in Australia and New Zealand, and it's the cousin of the organism that caused the Irish potato blight as well. So these fungi and things that are like fungi are very, they've evolved to be very damaging to trees.
You've been to New Zealand, though, have you not?
Yes, I was fortunate enough to come a couple of years ago to the Word Festival in Christchurch.
That's right.
And what a fantastic thing that was. And I was so kind of thrilled with the warm reception I got. I don't know, there's something maybe about a British sense of humour and a New Zealand one that coincides or a sort of similar sensibility, because it was just I felt incredibly at home and incredibly welcome.
Because we laughed at your jokes.
It always helps, you know.
And a couple of mentions in the book of New Zealand flora, punga, New Zealand's tree fern, in which you describe an interesting fashion in 1840s Victorian England for ferns. And so heaps of people imported the punga and it became an ideal garden ornament. But why did they go crazy for ferns?
Well, I think it was partly because there wasn't any of that sort of brash sexuality of flowers and all that birds and bees stuff.
Oh.
Ferns seem quite kind of restrained, don't they? They're You know, if you look at a leaf, its pattern is repeated in the whole plant, you know, so there's a sort of predictability about it, perhaps an orderedness, I think, that appealed to the Victorian sensibility. Charles Dickens persuaded his, or tried to persuade his daughter to collect ferns. It was seen as the right kind of thing for young ladies to do. And you know, fern expeditions were one of the few things that where men and women could mix quite freely and meet, you know, without sort of disapproving glances in Victorian times. So I think all of that made ferns, you know, sort of quite appealing to the Victorians. And I suspect that those people didn't actually know about the sex life of ferns, which is quite complicated. But you know, the key salient feature of it is that they have swimming sperm, and that's why you need damp environments for ferns, because the little sperm need to, you know, swim around a bit.
Also, the tree fuchsia, the kotukutuku, gets a mention. Why?
I just love the idea that the largest fuchsia in the world is in New Zealand. I like the fact that there's a sort of Maori connection. You know, in the there's a I don't know the original Maori language, but why weren't you here during the tree fuchsia leaf fall means, you know, where were you when we needed you? There's this wonderful blue pollen that bellbirds get sort of doused in and then sort of fly off to the next tree, taking the male sex cells which are in the pollen to the next tree. And that blue pollen apparently was used, you know, in the sort of pre-contact days, occasionally by young people as a sort of a cosmetic, sort of lip cosmetic.
I wonder if it was used in body art and moko
I think
tattoos.
it wasn't. I don't think it was used in tattooing. I think it was more on as a sort of lip colouring. I understand. It's an example of a tree which is very much at risk because of the brush-tailed possums, which were brought in for the fur trade in about 1830 or so from Australia. And the thing about Australia, as I understand it, is that everything but everything is out to get you, whether you're a human being or a possum. And so they have snakes and bushfires and dingoes and everything else. But in New Zealand, there was nothing to hold back possums, and they've been eating eating these wonderful kotukutuku trees.
I'd never thought about it before, but you talk about kava in relation to its use as an alcoholic beverage in the Pacific Islands. But we've got a tree here called kawa kawa, which is also peppery, and I think it is related to kava. And I wondered whether you could make kava from kawa kawa as well. I don't know.
Well, this is one of those moments when I say, well, I'm awfully glad you asked me that question, but I actually don't know. I don't know the answer. And what I would do would be find someone else who's tried it and lived and see whether it's a good thing to make it out of. Because the trouble with common names is that you know, they don't define a plant very well, you know. So what in one place is called the kawa kawa will be in another place called something else, and another place called something else, and they all refer to different plants, possibly. That's why we have Latin names, you know. Is it's a sort of you know, so everyone knows exactly which plant they're talking about. If they are related, then you know, if indigenous people have been using it, then I would think it's probably okay.
Talking about Australia, Australia had the bright idea of introducing prickly pear in order to get the cochineal from the insect that only lives on prickly pear, I understand. But this was, as was the possum experiment in New Zealand, a bit of a disaster, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, cochineal insects had been bred and farmed by the Aztecs for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And they were so sort of highly bred to live on the prickly pear plants that grow in Mexico that basically they didn't want to live, these little cochineal beetles. They didn't want to live anywhere else. So when Europeans started growing prickly pears in all their spots around their empires, in order to grow cochineal on them. And they wanted the cochineal, obviously, as a dye. So Cromwell's soldiers were wearing uniforms in cochineal-dyed clothing, and the Star-Spangled Banner was dyed with cochineal. And, you know, everyone wanted this stuff. They planted masses and masses of it in Australia. What could possibly go wrong? And, of course, the little cochineal insects, terribly fussy, didn't want to eat the cactus, and so there was nothing to keep the cactus in check. And by about 1925, 100,000 square miles, that's 260,000 square kilometers of Australian grazing land, had been lost to the prickly pear, and people were slashing it and burning it and dumping arsenic on it, and you know, nothing worked. And eventually they introduced a not so fussy little moth from Mexico called Cactoblastis, brilliant name. And Cactoblastis has been chomping its way through prickly pear ever since. And, there was an outpouring of gratitude when this thing, took off and worked. And there were lots and lots of Cactoblastis moths all sort of distributed around the place. And in Queensland, at Boonarga, there's a memorial hall called the Cactoblastis Memorial Hall. And, you know, all around Australia, there are these little monuments to Cactoblastis. But cochineal is making a comeback, actually, because, a bit like with indigo and other dyes that are natural, people are sort of trying to, have organic compounds instead of the ones that are derived from coal tar and things. And so carmine, in red lipstick, is often made out of cochineal, and in some countries Campari, the drink, is still made with cochineal.
Really? I'm not sure whether I'm in favour of grinding up little beetles for lipstick.
People will feel all sorts of different ways about it, but I should think that if you're vegetarian, then you really wouldn't want to use carmine based lipstick. I mean, these things are usually labelled if you look very closely.
I feel as if this book could have been much bigger, encompassing more than 80. So keen are you? Did any plants hit the cutting room floor? Oh, that's a plant joke, right?
Choosing 80 trees out of 60,000 species was difficult, but choosing 80 plants, some of which are trees, out of 450,000 or so plants that I could choose was very difficult indeed. And there are all sorts of things that hit the cutting room floor. The oak tree, In the end, what I was trying to do was make sure that whether it was history or science or folklore or culture, that there'd be something new for everyone in every story. And with the oak tree, I just sort of thought, do you know what? I haven't got anything that's quite exciting enough. And so compared with the other species in the book, you wouldn't believe what people used to get up to with pineapples and all sorts of things that I learned, which I just thought, that's just fantastic. And in the end, I sort of, if I had a really aha moment about a species, then it was in. And if I didn't, then I'm afraid it ended up on the floor.
You have to tell me about the pineapples now.
Okay, so in the 19th century, eventually, early 19th century, people managed to coax pineapples into growing in Britain. Originally, they'd come with Christopher Columbus over to Europe, and amazingly one survived, and of course everyone wanted one. So when they managed to get them to flower and then to fruit by having these fantastic coal-fired glass houses and things, they were associated with nobility and aristocracy and so on. And of course, the British, being incredibly class conscious, all wanted one. And when they first grew in Britain, they were so expensive that even rich people wouldn't eat them, but instead they rented them out to take people to take the parties. So you know how people have these chihuahuas that they take in a little kind of handbag to as a sort of posing thing. Well, people used to do that with pineapples. I mean, just extraordinary. And There was a time when the pineapple, the word pineapple, just meant anything that was absolutely fabulous and great. You know, so people used to say, I went to a party and it was just the very pineapple of a party. I met this guy, this chap was a perfect pineapple. This is around the beginning of the 19th century. I love that.
And you quote Charles Lamb as saying, pineapple is too ravishing for mortal taste. She woundeth and excoriateth the lips that approach her, like lovers' kisses she biteth. Does she woundeth and excoriateth the lips because of the outside of the pineapple, or is because it's got a thing about it, pineapple, that makes people a bit not allergic but sensitive?
Yes, I mean, I think that description might say as much about Charles Lamb as anything else, but pineapples absolutely do contain enzymes that can be used for tenderizing meat, and therefore can cause your lips to bleed. The enzyme is called bromelain, and there's quite a lot of it in pineapple. And there have been cases where people, soldiers or whatnot, have been stranded on islands, and the only thing they had to eat was pineapples. And their mouths and teeth were in quite a bad way by the time they were rescued. Pineapples, in moderation.
What are you working on now?
Oh gosh, I'm
Many
thinking
things.
About. Yes, I, because I split my time sort of with plants and strategy and technology and a whole load of things. But I think that I'm finding more and more that fungi are just kind of strange and curious and live these parallel lives that really we don't know much about. And they're a separate kingdom. Sometimes people think fungi are plants, but actually, in many ways, they've got more in common with animals, their cell structure and so on. And they, in the same way that plants and animals are their own kingdoms, fungi are their own kingdom as well. I mean, the thing that I suppose was most of a shock about the around the world in 80 trees, if I did as a kind of hobby, was just how popular it suddenly was. I got invited to New Zealand, and I got invited to India and all sorts of places. And it's in about 18 languages now. And I hadn't realised just how the combination of science and history and folklore and so on was something that was rather unusual. It's something that my parents kind of brought me up with. And most books, I think, are one subject or another. And I remember going around Kew Gardens when I was little with my dad, and he used to sort of tell me stories about the plants, and he used to feed bits of them to me as well. I remember him feeding me a bit of opium poppy at the time, giving me a lick of opium poppy. And, that was a latex that I felt on my tongue. And I remember it didn't have much effect, really. It just made my tongue go a little bit numb, but it had a huge effect on my teacher when I told her, and they called the social worker, who turned up at my, to talk to my mum during the day. So, plants were very much part of my sort of upbringing, I suppose, and stories about plants. And so trying to bring in lots of different aspects was what I was trying to do with that book and this one.
You would have read, just talking about fungi, you would have read Sheldrake's book about it, would you?
Yeah, he lives just up the road from me, yeah, and that's fantastic. So, I really like his work, and it's a wonderful book. And I think that to complement it, something about the different kinds of fungi, which is not really something he goes into so much, and their relationship with humans, I think might be something I'd be interested in.
That was Jonathan Drury. Around the World in 80 Plants is the book he was talking about, and he's coming to the Word Festival in Christchurch. Coming to is talking at. Let's be vague about it at this point in our COVID evolution, sometime later this year.